Iowa holds the coveted First in the Nation contest to decide who will be nominated for president. But how secure is the future of the Iowa caucuses? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll talk about the past and the future of the Iowa caucuses with David Yepsen of the Paul Simon Institute and Jody Winterhoff, who helped lead Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. Then Gary Wells, a professor of cognitive and social psychology at Iowa State University. He'll tell us about a homicide case in Oregon and how his research is causing courts to rethink eyewitness testimony in criminal cases. First, this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa holds the coveted First in the Nation contest to decide who will be nominated for president. But how secure is the future of the Iowa caucuses? That's a question we'd like to explore this half hour with others. With our guests, David Yepsen, director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. David Yepsen has covered politics, as most of you know, I'm sure, as a reporter, political editor, and political columnist for the Des Moines Register for more than 30 years. David Yepsen joins us by phone. Welcome, David.
It's good to be with you.
Jody Winterhoff is with us in our Ames studio, vice president for policy and advocacy, currently at the global humanitarian organization CARE. Jody Winterhoff has worked on multiple presidential campaigns, most recently in 2008. The Iowa State Director and Senior Strategist for the Hillary Clinton campaign for president. She's also been Chief of Staff in Senator Tom Harkin's Capitol Hill office. Jody Winterhoff in our Ames studio. Welcome to you.
So good to be here.
Let's talk, mention an event that both of you will be attending this evening, along with Terry Nelson, who served as a National Political Director for the Bush-Cheney 04 campaign. And in 2010 was a senior advisor to the National Republican Senate Committee. You're going to discuss the role of Iowa's First in the Nation caucuses during a panel discussion tonight at Iowa State University at 7:30 in the Memorial Union, the future of the caucuses, free and open to the public, that event. Let's start off with our most recent caucus earlier this year. And we have nearly a year's hindsight, if we want to round it off that way. To look back on it. Most notable this year for the kerfuffle in counting, initially declaring Mitt Romney a winner, when in fact Rick Santorum had won by just a few votes. David Yepsen, nearly a year after that miscount, what can you tell us about the damage that did to the Iowa caucus's name?
I think the damage was considerable. The Iowa caucuses are always criticized by other people in other states, for a variety of reasons, and for Iowa Republicans to flub the counting of the results really damaged the caucuses. And I did hear from other friends of mine in the media and people in the political community that it was really unfortunate because it may, in fact, diminish the significance of the Iowa caucuses in the mm-hmm. future. That's one of the purposes of our panel discussion tonight. We're up there at the invitation of the Harkin Institute to try to talk about the future of the caucuses and perhaps discuss things that Iowa can be doing to protect them in the future.
Let's talk about that in a moment. May I put the same question to you? The counting problem or other things, what stood out for you, Jody Winterhoff, about the 2012 caucuses in Iowa?
Well, I do think there is concern, and I certainly have heard it as well, about the counting. But I do think that how seriously Iowans take the caucus process in both parties is important. And I think the reminder for all of us in the process was we take it seriously, individuals take it seriously across the state, and we have to put resources and infrastructure in place to support the counting, to support these efforts. Mm-hmm. And it's not inexpensive. And so I do think it was a reminder to us that we have a responsibility, both in terms of participation and in terms of execution.
Jody Winterhoff, make the case. Why should keeping the Iowa's First in the Nation status be such a public policy concern for the state?
Well, I think in terms of the dialogue that happens on a number of issues during the caucus process, when you have candidates coming here multiple times, if you were a state in which the candidates came one or two times and sort of gave their standard stump speeches, you would not have a policy dialogue that you actually end up having and a debate at different times around issues. Individuals get to pose questions directly, and candidates have to answer those questions unfiltered, you know, in living rooms and gyms all across the state.
Mm-hmm. David Jepson, but surely other states, Iowa's not so singular that it could be the only one to fulfill the role that Jody just described. Why not rotate it around it and stop ignoring most of the other states in the country in this leadoff position?
Well, first of all, that idea has been suggested, and the parties could not agree among themselves and inside themselves on a way to do that. What has evolved is a system that I think addresses the question you raise. We now have Iowa is not the end of the process. It is the beginning of the process. The states of New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada have been institutionalized really by both parties as the leadoff contests in the nomination fight. So I think that some of that criticism about the importance of, you know, Iowa being the only place, it's not true. The campaign goes for a long time, as Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama proved in 2008. It's also important to Iowa for a couple other reasons. First, the caucuses have contributed to the building of a healthy two-party system in Iowa. The modern-day Democratic Party was built from about 1972 on, in large part because of the activism of the caucuses. Secondly, it puts Iowa's issues on the national agenda, and that's important to rural America. And third, it attracts people into the process. There are many people active in Iowa politics today who got there by first starting out working in a caucus campaign. Mm-hmm. I first met Tom Vilsack in 1987 on the streets outside Joe Biden's headquarters, and this young mayor of Mount Pleasant was there to volunteer to help Joe Biden. So it's an entry point for people to stay active in politics.
We just heard a few days ago Governor Branstad talking about the Iowa straw poll, a much different animal, but saying that it has outlived its usefulness. Not a very good predictor of who will be nominated by the Republicans. Do you think that some of the same criticism could be leveled at the Iowa caucuses? Jody Winterhoff.
Well, in terms of the straw poll, I think that is sort of a different beast, if you will. And I do think there's an opportunity to have marquee events. There are certainly large dinners that both parties have traditionally had. But I do think having something like the straw poll is really where folks outside of Iowa do feel we start to have two bites at the apple. Mm. And I do think that's where people start to question the role and what they might be able to do in their states. And so I think it's a legitimate question to bring forward. I think just in terms of just the practical side of it, I also think it's an event that costs the Republican Party a lot of money. And so I would wonder how much money do they raise from it, really? And obviously it raises the profile. But if it's really about building the party and the resources, does it do that mm-hmm. to the degree that a dinner or something else could?
David Jepson, how is the Iowa straw poll seen by insiders? I mean, you pay a lot of money if you're with a campaign to participate in this some sort of measure of a popularity of a candidate, but we don't really know what that measure indicates, do we?
No, and I think most political insiders, especially after this last year, have concluded that this is the too much emphasis is placed on it, too many resources are put into it. It's a sideshow. It's a waste of time, and that's where the governor is coming from. This was a fun event when it started. But it's evolved into something now where it's just gotten out of control. Democrats in their party, I don't know, Jody, I mean, the Democrats got out of the straw poll business in about 1988 because these things do distract from the purpose of the campaign. And let's remember, the purpose of this exercise, of these caucuses, is to nominate a candidate who can win the White House. It's not about debates. It's not about straw polls. It's not about how much money is spent on hotels in Des Moines. It's not about civic participation. It's about winning an election. And so anything that's done that is counterproductive in either party to that party's goal of picking a winner, you really have to question what the purpose is. And I think a lot of insiders are now asking that question about this straw poll.
Join our conversation the next few minutes, 10 or 15 minutes. We'll be talking about the Iowa caucuses, 1-866-780-9100. Do you think Iowa should always be the leadoff state in the nomination process? Perhaps you have a better idea. Do you think, as our guest suggests, more resources need to be put toward the Iowa caucuses to support the Iowa caucuses as an institution in this country? 1-866-780-9100. Bill is joining us from Sac City. Hi, Bill. How do you see this?
Hi, Ben and Jody, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
My comment is that the Republican straw poll on the Republican side of the caucuses allows for the very conservative element with Bob Vanderplaats and the family leader to mobilize with their money and organization. And it seems they're able to get their followers out to these relatively two small meetings, such as the straw polls and the caucuses. And a small motivated group carries a lot of weight, which is really disproportionate to their numbers. Michelle Bachmann, as you know, won the straw poll, and Rick Santorum won the caucuses. And both of these candidates are two of the religious right's chosen ones. And what it does is it causes the GOP to dance to the right here in Iowa and become less electable on a national stage, as really the Bob Vanderplaats family leader group is effective only in the state of Iowa. And nationwide, the caucuses, to me, appear to be an albatross to the GOP as they promote an unelectable presidential candidate. And the straw polls and the GOP side of the caucuses are one of the best things going for the Democratic Party. And if I did not know better, I would believe the caucuses on the GOP side were almost a Democratic ploy to win the presidency. And I think it begs the question if they are even in the best interest of the company. And I really appreciate your comments.
Bill, thank you. That's quite a comment, only in the interest of the Democratic Party. David Yepsen, what do you think about that heavy criticism?
No, I think he's right. And I think, in fact, that's one of the reasons why the Democratic Party got out of the straw poll business. The Republicans right now have an issue with people who are too zealous, too conservative, who alienate voters in the middle. Democrats have had this same problem before in Iowa. In 1972 with the McGovern debacle, in 1984 it was the nuclear freeze people, and there was this concern that if you do these straw polls, a handful of people can manipulate the results, you wind up with a lot of media attention being paid to something that really misleads people. So I think the caller is right, and I think it's a problem both parties have. The solution is what Governor Bransett has talked about. Do away with the straw poll. Keep the focus on the main event itself. Keep the organizations working on the caucuses. The thing that Republicans are, they're looking at here now is that this straw poll knocked Tim Pawlenty out of the race. And he might, in fact, have been a pretty good candidate in November. And so he should have had an opportunity to argue his case to the Iowa Republican caucus universe rather than just people who were so motivated to go buy a ticket and show up in Ames.
Greg tweets, one of our listeners, Greg tweets, Iowans take their role seriously. All candidates are heavily vetted and made to show organizational management skills. You were on the inside of several presidential campaigns, Jody Winterhoff. It is a test of sorts, isn't it?
It absolutely is a test. And I do think, back to the past caller, that Governor Romney did organize significantly well in Iowa. And so I do think that it was kind of a mixed result, if you will. But I think taking that through to the general election, I don't think that the Romney campaign did everything they could have done in terms of organization and management. And so somewhere along the way, I feel like some of the organizing they did do here in Iowa, they didn't carry to some of their national effort.
If Iowa were not the leadoff state, would Republicans, I don't know what other state you might pick, but would Republicans have to dance so far to the right, what was mentioned by Bill in Sac City, as to then have to do this dance back to a more moderate position, Jody, you think?
Well, I think if you look at the results across many of the battleground states, that seems to be what was happening in many of those states. That issue in terms of going more to the right to get the base excited in the vice presidential pick and in the ticket that was put forward. But I also think then, there are turnout questions, and it seems to me that looking at the demographics is they're starting to bump their head against some limits in terms of the demographics and putting together a winning vote across the country. So I don't think this was just or is just an issue in Iowa. I think it's an issue in multiple battleground states for the Republican Party, and they're going to have to sort it out.
A few more minutes with Jody Winterhoff and David Yepsen talking about the future, past and future of the Iowa caucuses. James is joining us from Des Moines. James, is it important to you that Iowa hold on to these caucuses? Not that they're in jeopardy.
Well, absolutely. I remember going to one up here from the Heartlands and being able to ask the question about who they would appoint to the Supreme Court and to get that question answered. And I think David knows, by the way, hello, David.
Hello.
I think David knows that that question couldn't be asked in California because they would not get that close to the people. And those questions are really pertinent to what we have. Look at the Supreme Court we have now. And they're for life. Those appointments are for life.
James, thank you. In Des Moines. Before we run out of time, let's get your views, Jody and David, about your recommendations about keeping the caucuses safe for Iowa, in Iowa Territory. David Yepsen.
Well, first you have to recognize that nothing is carved in stone. Iowans in both parties who want to keep this have to constantly be fighting to keep them first. And one way you do that is to listen to the critics and to try to improve the quality of the events. I mean, we have Democrats. It used to not be a crime to falsely report caucus results. The legislature changed the law, and Governor Branstad was involved in that. So I think quality improvement. And Jody raised it earlier, putting efforts into the infrastructure to count these results. Mm-hmm. After 2000, Americans are very sensitive about quick counts and accurate counts. The Iowa Republican Party has got to come up with a system to quickly tabulate these results. I think one idea that has to be considered by the state is simply having the county auditors do it. These are people who report election results all the time. They have poll watchers. Let them go to the caucuses. Let them be responsible for turning in the results. And yes, it may cost some money, but I would submit that just like New Hampshire, the state of New Hampshire puts money into its primary, Iowa ought to think about putting some tax dollars into the administration and tabulation of caucus results. Then that way the counties could be subsidized a little bit for the cost of going to these caucuses and reporting the results through their reporting mechanisms. I think it would solve the problem that the Republicans have. But that's the kind of thing we have to think about.
Okay. You mentioned listening to critics, David and Jody. What about this? I'll list a litany of criticisms of the Iowa caucuses. Respond here. Do we need to change it? It's on the Democratic side, it's not really a secret ballot. You have to publicly state your opinion. Vote. You're in a gymnasium. You're somewhere. Time. It involves a couple hours. People who have to work, people who can't make it, are taken out of the vote there. Absentee ballots not allowed. The rules are kind of strange for counting up people and putting a precinct in one column or the other. Do you change anything there, Jody Winterhoff?
Well, I do think you need to look at the participation and the timing of the caucuses. I think that's a legitimate question. And how can you open them up a little bit more? In the same breath, I also think, you know, per David's comments earlier, the work around the caucuses is try to see who is going to win the election and try to put forth the best candidate. And one of the things that happens in the caucuses is the organizing piece. And we certainly saw that with President, then Senator Obama in 2008. Their organizing ability outshone the rest of the field. And I think we can't overlook that as well.
Including with your campaign with Hillary Clinton, that was a big surprise on caucus night 2008.
Well, some of us would say it wasn't as much of a surprise to us as it was to some in the effort. However, it was extraordinary in terms of the turnout, and I do think that boded well for that being a year of change election, of him being able to be elected, and frankly, I think it carried on over into this election most recently. But I do think we have to look at how can we have more people participate, and David's comments about, well, if auditors are involved in this, maybe there is a way to open it up a little bit more and have those pieces counted. But not also at the detriment of building those activists, advocates, party infrastructure, and seeing if those candidates have that kind of muscle as well.
David Yepsen, on the Democratic side, would you suggest any reforms?
No. And in fact, in 1983, Iowa cut a deal with New Hampshire, and that was Iowa would have the first caucus, New Hampshire would have the first primary. The two states quit fighting. If you did what you were talking about there, absentee ballots, secret votes, you'd effect turn the Iowa Democratic caucuses into a primary, and that would get you in all kinds of trouble with New Hampshire. So Democrats are stuck with the process. I think their national party could do well to define how those caucuses should be conducted. I mean, Iowa wasn't the only state that had problems with caucuses in 2008 on the Democratic side. You know, one other thing, though, that I think they ought to think about doing is doing these on Saturday night, you know, instead of Monday night. The Democrats have resisted that idea because it is the Jewish Sabbath, but the Sabbath ends after sundown, and that's about 6 p.m. on Saturday night in January in Iowa. And I think Iowa should consider holding these events on Saturday evening at 6:30 or 7 o'clock. It would enable more people to go to their respective events, get away for a couple hours, locate some child care if that's what you needed, have students who would be able to provide child care. I think it's an idea that ought to be considered as a way of opening this process up to more Iowans.
You said there was a lot of damage done by this last caucus miscount. David, I mentioned that the caucuses weren't under any threat, but I wonder, do you think that they're under any threat?
Well, not formally, but what if you gave a party and nobody came? Right now, in both parties, people are making decisions about 2016. And Iowa has to, do I go to Iowa and spend 6 months of my life and $10 million of my money only to get cheated out of a result at the end? And so many candidates may try the bypass Iowa strategy, which hasn't really worked well in the past, but maybe going forward. So that's why it's important that Iowa, both parties, address these concerns right now, so that candidates who are thinking about running in both parties will know, hey, Iowa had some problems, they've made some changes, whatever those changes are, and we think it's worth campaigning out there.
David Yepsen, do you think there's a political will for making these changes?
Oh, I think so, because if Democrats and Republicans in Iowa don't want to make a few of these minor changes, you know, you'll be given a party and nobody will show up.
Okay. Jody Winterhoff, you have a few seconds left. What haven't we mentioned that you'd like to put out there?
Well, I think just the piece of Iowa and New Hampshire have worked hand in glove, as David mentions, for decades on this. And that looks like it will continue to move forward, as well as the parties working together. And so I do think there's sort of a gathering, if you will, a force that will continue. And that has stayed together for a number of years. I see that continuing. And I think that the answer of big states versus something like this partnership, becomes a very difficult question for the parties to really say, that's the way we should do this. That's the better way to pick candidates. And I think that the parties will ultimately stay with this system.
Mm-hmm. David Yepsen, quickly, what do you see in the future of the Iowa caucuses? It evolving eventually into something else?
No, you know, the one thing the caucuses do have going for them is momentum, you know, inertia. They're in motion. Other people have tried to change it over the years. Somebody's always unhappy. The world can't come to an agreement on what that is, so that helps Iowa.
We thought that about the Iowa straw poll, that it had momentum too, but look what one pronouncement by the governor can do.
Yeah, right, and the Republicans had a problem with that straw poll, and it's now being talked about being changed. They've also got a problem with their counting on election night, and they need to address that too.
Okay, I want to thank you, too, very much for joining us to talk about the caucuses, the future of it, your event. And once again, the two of you, along with Terry Nelson, who served for the Bush-Cheney 2004 campaign, 2004 campaign, will be discussing this tonight at Iowa State University, the future of the Iowa caucuses, exploring the reasons why Iowa should keep its influential role in electing the nation's president. Also look at the caucuses' political and economic impacts on the state. 7:30 tonight at Iowa State University's Memorial Union's Great Hall, and it's open and free to the public. Thank you, David. Thank you, Jody.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with Gary Wells. We talked with him a while ago. He's a professor of cognitive and social psychology at Iowa State University. He'll tell us about a homicide case in Oregon, this murder case, and how his research is causing courts to rethink eyewitness testimony in criminal cases. Fascinating discussion. I hope you'll stay with us. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for tuning in over the noon hour. Next, this half hour, a case that gives eyewitness testimony in criminal cases a second skeptical look. Listen to this. In 2003, former Marine Norris Hild was shot and killed at a campground in Oregon. Sam Lawson was convicted of that murder based largely on eyewitness testimony. Eyewitness testimony by the murdered man's wife, Cheryl Hild, whom also was shot during that incident, severely wounded. Last week, the Oregon Supreme Court ordered a new trial for Lawson. During the first trial, the judge would not allow testimony on the problematic nature of eyewitness testimony to be heard by the jury. My next guest is Gary Wells. He's a professor of cognitive and social psychology at Iowa State University. He's a leading researcher in eyewitness testimony, and Wells was one of the memory scientists, researchers who filled an America's brief with the Innocence Project that brought about the Oregon v. Lawson trial. His research was used in that trial as well. Gary Wells, welcome back to our program.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Before we get to the problems in eyewitness identification, give us a picture of what we think happened on that campground. Can you outline what we know happened on that campground in Oregon in 2003?
Well, the main thing that we know that happened was that this couple had pitched camp at this particular place. When they returned at one point, there was someone who was in their camp. That individual indeed what does turn out to be the defendant in this case. But they that individual left. And then at some point later that night, someone came and shot the husband and the wife. She said all along that she could that she did not get a good look at his face. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she was shown a photo spread with the man who was in the camp earlier. The defendant in this case, Lawson, and could not identify him. They turned around and showed her a photo lineup again with Lawson in it, but this time with different people. Later, she still could not identify him. This went on and on until finally they suggested to her that they had suspected the person who was in the camp, and she still could not make an identification until at one point they showed her a single photo of Lawson. So it's really a very suggestive procedure all the way through.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm understanding you correctly, Lawson convicted of the murder largely based on this eyewitness testimony of the murdered man's wife, Cheryl Hild, and that they actually presented the defendant's picture in a series of lineups, and his picture was the only common element in this series, and they coached him, it sounds like, almost coached him into, or coached her into picking this man.
Yes, until at some point she finally did. And the interesting twist on this, which is not at all surprising to me, we see this pattern over and over again, is that when she got to court, she said, I knew all along, I'll never forget his face, I knew it instantly. Very unusual kinds of statements, but we understand that process of, a lot better now, where someone really does not have a recollection, but they end up with one later.
Right. In reading the account, I believe actually she was the first one shot. She was in the camping trailer, hit in the shoulder, I think, by a bullet. Didn't know really what it was. Called for her husband. Her husband came, and he was shot and never uttered another word after being shot.
Yes.
And then the man, whoever did this, came into the trailer and put a pillow over her face, so she had a difficult time identifying who that was. But when asked, while she was on the floor of this camping vehicle, the first question, "Who do you know who shot her?" The answer was
no, she did not know.
She did not know. Talk about how, in your area of expertise, how the brain processes an eyewitness identification. Because there are several steps, right? There's the familiarity of the face, and then there's the placing of the face, at a certain time and at a certain place. How does that work in our brains?
Well, you know, often, you know, memory and, you know, can work very well, but, it, you know, there's several stages it has to go through. I mean, and all those stages have to be successful. And the first is acquisition. I mean, you have to be, you have to acquire the memory and acquire those details, encode them in the first place. Then you have to retain them. There are a lot of things that interfere with retention. Obviously, the passage of time does, but also other things that are going on. And then, at the time of recognition, you have to retrieve that memory. Mm-hmm. And if memory fails at any one of those points, then it's not going to be successful.
How good is the science in knowing how suggestion can reshape a memory?
It's actually very good now. You know, we've been working on this kind of thing. I've been working on this eyewitness identification issue for actually now just slight over 35 years. And, you know, we now have a very good scientific literature there. And one of the interesting things is that, you know, that we now know is that this is not all just about memory. It's also about suggestion. It's about the development of beliefs that that come from other sources that then substitute for your memory. It's the development of false memories that then are based on those beliefs, and it's a very dynamic process.
Mm-hmm. So in this case or another case, if we have law enforcement people continually telling us or edging toward the answer that they want, we will perhaps believe in good faith that our memory is correct in its reshaping.
Absolutely, in good faith. I mean, in general, you know, these kinds of eyewitness situations, the witness, if they're wrong, it's not because they're lying. It's not because they want to be wrong. They want to be right. But what they're doing, of course, which is a natural human tendency, is to look for all possible sorts of information. If you can't rely strictly on your memory, you can't sort of solve this just with your memory, you're listening to what the detective says. You're trying to put two and two together. You're trying to really, you know, help solve this crime. And then memory then is malleable. It's changeable. It involves processes of construction. So you can construct a memory after the fact. It becomes, you know, I have no doubt that by the time she got to trial, when she thinks back to that shooting, she sees Lawson's face. Mm-hmm. Even though initially there was no face there.
Right.
She admitted from the outset.
Why did the Innocence Project get involved with this particular case?
Well, in general, this particular case represents a very good example, a very concrete example of something that that we've been observing for many, many years. The legal system has a way of trying to look at eyewitness identification cases involving suggestiveness like this that was actually set down in 1977 by the U.S. Supreme Court. Every state then came along and sort of adopted this same approach. From the U.S. Supreme Court, it's called the case is called Manson versus Braithwaite, and it's basically the law of the land. Every state kind of came up with their own version. In Oregon, it's called Clausen, Oregon versus Clausen. And here's how it works, because it's actually very interesting, and it's flawed. The way it works is if someone, for example, the defense makes an argument that, look, this was a highly suggestive procedure, you know, she starts off saying she has no memory, you keep showing her the same person over and over again. You tell her that you know that was the person who was earlier in the camp, which she couldn't figure out on her own, and then she ends up, you know, being, you know, making what is claimed to be an identification. And what the court says, and it said in Manson or Oregon's version and Clausen, every state has their own version of this, but they're all the same. And it says, look, the first thing, that you do a two-prong test to decide whether to admit this evidence against the defendant. First prong, decide, was it suggestive? The court looked at this. They said, yes, it is suggestive. But when you agree that it's suggestive, you simply go to the second prong. And the second prong is, okay, it was suggestive, but that doesn't mean that we won't admit that identification. So we go to a second prong and start asking, well, is the witness certain? Does the witness say they had a pretty good view and that they were paying attention? And if the answer to those is yes, the witness says, hey, I'm certain. Yeah, I was paying attention. Yeah, I had a pretty good view. Then it's admitted. In other words, those things trump the suggestiveness. Now, back in the 90s, late 90s, 1998 actually was when this was published, we discovered here at Iowa State in our labs a very interesting phenomenon that goes to the very heart of the problem with the Manson criteria. And it is that when you give, when you use a suggestive procedure, not only does it increase the likelihood that the witness will make a mistake, but it also makes the witness certain. It makes the witness think they had a good view. It makes the witness say that they were paying close attention. So there's a real backwardness to the Manson test, namely that when you use this second prong to try to decide if there's a problem with the suggestiveness, it turns out witnesses will always pass it. But they're passing the second prong because it was suggestive. Mm-hmm. And so the court recognized that in this case. I've been writing about that actually since 1983. The court recognized it and embraced that and decided to throw out the Manson test.
And also, perhaps you're also alluding to this too, but it seems to me if I was in that case, weeks upon weeks of saying he did it, he did it, he did it, it can only harden my view on it because I would be terribly embarrassed if then I really did have a question about it. Even if I did, I might not air that.
Well, that's right. I mean, a couple of things happen, a couple of very interesting psychological processes. One is you become increasingly committed. Most of your listeners probably have heard of the idea of cognitive dissonance. Going back on something that you've invested in like that arouses anxiety, arouses cognitive dissonance, and so we tend to avoid doing that. The other is, though, that every time, that once she sort of becomes convinced, only because of what the detectives told her, that that's the person, she starts sticking that in as she thinks back to this horrible event. She starts sticking that image, in this case of Lawson, into her memory. The more you put it in there, right, the more he becomes, you know, the person. So, yeah, certainty inflates over a period of time like that.
I wonder if you can tell us then, we certainly want to use eyewitness identification in some way in criminal cases. So what has your research told us about new guidelines for improving the way law enforcement uses eyewitness ID?
Well,
do's and don'ts.
Right. I mean, you know, there's standard. There's a standard protocol that we've developed, and I say we, myself, and my PhD students over the years. This is actually used in now in many states, including New Jersey and North Carolina and Ohio and so on. And it involves, first of all, instructing the witness that the person who committed the offense might not be in this lineup. And that it's just as important to free the innocent as it is to incriminate the guilty. That takes a lot of pressure off of them with regard to feeling like they need to make an identification. Secondly, making sure that all these fillers, fillers are the ones who in the lineup who you know didn't do it. They're just in there to fill it out. Making sure that they, too, fit the general description that the witness gave so that the person who you have as your suspected person doesn't stand out like a sore thumb. But also, the person who administers that photographic lineup or live lineup should be blind. I introduced this notion of the double blind lineup back in the 80s and that is that the person who is interacting with the witness and doing this and, you know, having these conversations about photos that are down in front of them does not know which one's a filler, which one's a suspect. So they can't selectively guide the witness. And then getting a certainty statement from the witness at the time in which they make their choice, not later, not waiting until they've been coached and reinforced and so on, but at the time. That's the only time in which, from our studies, we found that there's any kind of relation between certainty and accuracy of identification.
Now you mentioned a handful of states using these guidelines developed at ISU by you and your team, but it doesn't sound like a handful. Is very many? Are there a lot of law enforcement agencies? I didn't hear Iowa in that list either. Are people reluctant to make improvements to this process?
Well, let me answer the first part of that first, and then the second about the reluctance. In the first part, it's more widespread than the states I mentioned, just simply because those are, and I would include Connecticut in this as well, but those are places where something has been done statewide. That is, the whole state is now doing it through either legislative means, like in North Carolina and Ohio and Connecticut, or through by order of by administrative order of the Attorney General, which was done in New Jersey. But there are other places, many other places. Dallas, for example. I always like to mention Dallas. I worked with Dallas extensively on their reforming their procedures, Dallas Police Department. I always like to mention them because, hey, if you can get Dallas to do it, you can get anybody to do it is the argument. Denver, Minneapolis.
Since we're running out of time, let's move to the reluctance issue. Mm-hmm. For those who are reluctant, why reluctant to move to what appears to be scientifically based guidelines to go forward and improve?
Right. Well, I think some of it is ignorance. I mean, that they just don't know what the science shows. And so programs like this are very important to get the word out. You know, the police and the legal system is not really reading the social science literature per se, but a lot of good things have happened. You know, when I was on 60 Minutes, after that, I got phone calls from police chiefs across the country. So, but what happens? We have over 17,000 independent law enforcement agencies in the U.S. So, part of it's ignorance. Part of it is just kind of a catch-all here, or I shouldn't say a catch-all, but a kind of a problem where the pressure for this change is coming from the outside. It's coming from the science, not from the inside, not from inside the legal system. And anytime somebody from the outside is trying to tell people on the inside, "Hey, there's better ways to do these things," you're going to get some resistance. But in general, I think, you know, law enforcement is really pretty much on board, and it just takes time, and the legal system takes time to change.
To sort of bookend our conversation by going back to this case, the Oregon Supreme Court ordering a new trial for Sam Lawson, Oregon v. Lawson. When we look at the evolution of eyewitness testimony in criminal court cases, what does this specific case and this specific decision by the Oregon Supreme Court represent?
Well, it represents a very strong change in thinking and type of thinking. So, for example, what the court said is it said that the courtrooms will in fact have to pay attention to the science. They can no longer ignore the science, and so it's a very strong directive order like that. Secondly, it says that when there's evidence of suggestiveness, and this is throwing out Manson, when there's evidence of suggestiveness, the proof shifts then to the burden of proof shifts to the prosecution to get it in instead of to the defense as it has traditionally to keep it out. So that's a very strong shift in the burden of proof. And so it's a very big deal.
So will this one day end up at the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Manson?
It could, or the U.S. Supreme Court might at this point in looking at, because we throw an occasional case at them to try to get them to look at it, they might look at it and say, well, it looks like the states are starting to handle this themselves. So there's this almost irony that as you have success, it allows them to continue to push the ball down the road and not deal with it themselves.
We have less than a minute left. I wanted to ask you this question in closing, if I could, Gary Wells. As someone who has researched eyewitness testimony extensively over many years, what for you are out there as still the most important unanswered questions in your field?
Well, I think that, I mean, there are things that we certainly have never been able to solve, and I think never will be able to solve, and that is to try to figure out how, you know, whether any specific individual eyewitness is mistaken or accurate. The best we can do is talk about things that increase or decrease that probability. So it's a very probabilistic kind of science. And what we're trying to do is get the courts and the legal system to, in fact, recognize the probabilistic nature of this, but to do things to take advantage of where the probabilities lie.
Mm-hmm. So it's not a case as it's recorded on some chip-like thing in your brain, and we just have to get to the answer of what that memory is.
Well, you know, potentially, although I would put it out there at least 50 years in the future, that could happen, but not now.
Thank you very much for joining us. Gary Wells, professor of cognitive and social psychology at Iowa State University. We appreciate your fascinating insights and coming into our studio today. Thank you, Gary Wells.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan and in Ames, help from Jason Burns, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions, perhaps ideas for another show. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org, our email. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us.